Hornetti behind us right now from the Sociophonic Key from the Sun Ra El Saturn archives. Ham, are you there? Bunch of kids practicing enlightenment. Dirty Beaches featuring the Hong Kong band The Offset Spectacles, the track called Temple Street from a Russian tour split tape with Tonstart Band. The Feeling of Love before that from the LP Reward Your Grace. The track was called Julie Cruz. We opened that set with Girls' Names, Drawing Lines, the song from The New Life. That is everything we heard. You're tuned to WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay safe, my friends, and stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information's coming right up.
You're listening to WFMU. The show's Too Much Information. My name's Benjamin Walker, and our guest tonight is the cartoonist Gilbert Hernandez, one of the creators of the Lovin' Rockets comic series, which is now in its 30th year. Gilbert is on a sort of world tour of sorts to celebrate two new publications. One is called Marble Season, and the other one is called Julio's Day, and that's what brings him here. Welcome to WFMU, Gilbert.
No, glad to be here.
Well, thanks. Thanks for taking out some time to do this. I want to start with Marble Season, now out now from Drawn in Quarterly. It's being hyped as your first semi-autobiographical work, which of course sounds pretty exciting to someone like me who's been reading you since I was, you know, 16, 17 years old. So when I got in the mail, I dove right in, and I have to say that I became fascinated by a pretty big question in less than like 20 pages. You know, so many of the characters in this book, I feel like I already know. They might look different. Some might be boys now instead of girls, but it's obviously your world, a world that you've been populating with stories and characters for quite some time. So my first question is, what makes this work semi-autobiographical in ways that your other work isn't?
Well, I chose a lot of the sequences from real life. I changed the characters and you know, who it happens to, and you know, but pretty much that. Some of the stuff, like the Captain America play, that's something I actually attempted and failed. different things like that are real. Some of the other things I just made up just as sort of, you know, to fit the rest of the stuff together. It's like I said, it's semi-autobiographical, so it's not a literal translation of my childhood.
Yeah. No, but it's just that there are so many things that resonate. I mean, there's a few panels where, you know, our main character, Huey, is posed or thinking or talking about comics. It's almost like verbatim that Venus, another one of your characters, says and does, especially when, like, these two character Venus is a female young girl from some of your other comics. There's, like, a lot of crossover there.
Yeah, maybe I just write one story and just change the characters. That might be it.
No, but, you know, I guess as one of the famous Hernandez brothers telling a semi-autobiographical story, I can't help but hope to see scenes of you and Jaime and Mario plotting world domination in comics. And, you know, comics are a big part of Marble Season. Huey, uh-huh. Our main character, is obsessed with them, and his brother is too. So who is who here, I guess, when it comes to sort of the family getting involved in comics? How real is that?
Well, it's they're very generalized. I guess Junior would be a nice version of Mario, my older brother. Huey is a nicer version of me, and the little brother in their family, Chavo, would be a mixture of Jaime and my brother Ismael and my sister Lucinda. They were the youngest ones.
Uh huh.
So I kind of put them all together in that one little character. Little brothers and sister just never had a chance with the older brothers, let me tell you.
Yeah. But so where does the actual love of comics, you know, that becomes such a lifeblood of this family, you know, come from? It seems here it's the older brother who's into them, but he can't get he has to put them away because his grades are bad. But it seems like maybe they're coming from him. Is that where the Hernandez brothers got the comics bug?
Actually, it started in the 1940s with my mom. She liked comic books when she was a kid. The first comic she ever saw was a Captain Marvel comic, and right away she was smitten, and she was curious, and she started to collect comics and, you know, and just start to figure out what were good comics, what were not so good. And in the 50s, when she got married, you know, and she had Mario, she kind of dropped that behind. But then when Mario was old enough, like around 5 years old, they just happened upon, a convenience store or something and bought him a comic book. And she thought, I used to read these are fine, you know, for him to read. And my dad was the same thing. He goes, oh great, it keeps him quiet, so buy more of those. So that's how that actually started. So I was born into a world where there was already comic books in the house and they were okay to read.
You know, that's not the sense we get from this story. It's almost that the parents have, I mean, almost like an antagonistic attitude towards them. You know, the Junior's grounded from comics. The mom accidentally throws out some of Huey's prized, comic cards.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of a difference, I guess, from the actual story. Or?
Those things all really happened. I guess when we're very small, it was okay to read comics. And then once we got, you know, pretty much into them, obsessed with them, I guess it started to become a problem, or at least that's what our parents saw. You know, with my older brother Mario, just being too into comics and not enough into schoolwork. So they, you know, I exaggerated that whole story about him, you know, not being able to look at comics for a long time. That was actually a very short period. And his grades weren't that bad. They just wanted them to, you know, him to pick them up a little bit.
Yeah. At this point in the story in Marble Season, Huey gets a new friend, Chauncey, who has a lot of comics. And he actually, you know, sticks one under his shirt to take it home and feels very conflicted about it. But I love this scene. And did that really happen?
No, that was just a general representation of things, something that would happen. To be honest, that one, if it reads like it's realistic, it actually didn't happen, as far as I know.
I guess, yeah, no, it was strange. For me, it was the Charlie Brown finger puppets that this kid down the street, awful kids, but the older brother, you know, was like, we were all there. And I don't think I've thought of this until, you know, this scene and the story which brought it up. But it was, I remember like looking at this Linus finger puppet on this kid's shelf, and I just had to have it, and I shoved it in my pocket and ran home. Totally ashamed. I guess just the magic of comic imagery that just makes little kids go nuts.
Well, it doesn't mean that I didn't steal things, but that one particular comic books weren't something I stole. They were too big. I would steal little army soldiers or dinosaurs or something, you know.
Yeah, the Mars Attacks cards.
Well, yeah, those were definitely still. That's a true story. Both what happens when, you know, getting all 53 cards and then them getting thrown away, all that really happened.
Yeah, but you know, there are so many characters that seem to connect with other characters in a lot of your other work. So I guess what I was really trying to say is, like, what makes this semi-autobiographical is more, it just seems that there's a lot of autobiography in so much of your work from so many.
Yeah, there is, but I would change the names to protect the innocent, you know? I would basically, like you were talking about Venus earlier, I mean, I would have her into comics and have the same feelings and experiences that I may have had or a neighbor might have had, but it was still changed enough to where, you know, you couldn't find the true story if there was one. Whereas Marble Season is pretty close to what happened a lot of the times, and the particular things that happened, like the Mars Attacks cards or particular TV shows, you know, we watched at the time.
Yeah, and it's really amazing to see then, I guess, the roots of so many characters. It seems that, like, Lena, is it Lena or Lana?
I think it's Lana.
Lana.
I think.
So we have Lana, Lucio, and Barnabas. It seems that I know these characters from your work. But these are, like, the actual individuals where these characters come from, no?
No, they were made up, too. I just, my magical talent is to make these fictional characters seem like they're real.
Well, no, I guess these characters connect to characters that show up later in your work. I mean, there's other versions of these characters.
Well, I'm just doing the same characters in different costumes. That's pretty much it.
But these ones are not from childhood.
Little bit here and there. The Lana character, when she stops being a tomboy and wears a dress.
Yeah.
That actually has a horribly tragic ending, but I left that out of the book because I didn't want to have real downers in the book, just general downers, but not real heavy ones.
No, this is a very light and free book. But the brothers, Lucio and Barnabas, that show up, like when Lucio makes that entrance, he comes through Huey's window screaming and yelling. I mean, it's a wonderful character. But it seems that, like, that sort of rah, rah, rah energy is definitely something that I'm familiar with. I love that guy.
Yeah, that was huge. The representation of several kids I've known growing up. All of a sudden, they're in your face and they're in your lives, you know. But you allow it because they make it fun, you know.
Oh yeah, and one day you're one day you're friends, and the next day you're fighting, and the next day you're friends.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It struck me that after reading Marble Season, it struck me that, you know, a lot of critics and readers label your work as having this sense of magical realism. Do you even like that label, by the way? I always wondered.
That's just a handle. If it sells a couple of extra copies, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing is, it's all in my head. It's all a fantasy. It's all indulgence. It's all, whatever I feel like doing,
Yeah.
And I guess I just have a knack for separating them here and there, different stories, emphasizing it in one story and then omitting it completely from another one, like, say, Marvel Season.
Yeah. I guess I've always thought that label was just inadequate in that, it's your characters that always – these very, very strong – characters that have always stood out for me if I was going to put a label on. But it struck me reading Marvel Season that there's almost the way that children see the world, this like sense of wonder that is perhaps maybe a better way of like talking about the magic. I mean, we have the way that like Huey can see, the so much possibility in the way he looks at the sky, also something we've seen before with Venus, that, the sense of possibility of anything can happen. With your characters.
Yeah. That's what's great about kids. When you're 10 years old, the world is yours. Even if you're, suffering from school and getting yelled at from your folks or bullies or whatever, there's a part of you that just, just looks at the world like, it's all yours, even though you're in your little, little neighborhood.
Yeah. And it really, I think this book really shows how this viewpoint can work as a way of telling a story. But it seems that like this ability to see the world with so much possibility is something you've retained as an adult, and even in your adult work seems to work on this logic. Kid logic, almost, perhaps,
I'm I'm just immature.
It seems that there's a unique style that this book is drawn in. I mean, you've changed your style. You're capable of working in so many. I'm not even sure if I'm correct here. Is that true? Is there perhaps a unique, something different about this way, the way this book is drawn?
It's a lot simpler, a lot more direct. I didn't do anything fancy with it because I wanted it to read like an old, like we were talking of a Peanuts comic strip or an old kids comic that you picked up way back in the 60s, a little Lulu comic or Dennis the Menace or something like that. I wanted it to read like that. Even though it's still my type of nutty writing, just for it to read real simply from panel to panel, everything's very clear. The characters are drawn very simply, but a little extra line here and there, shows their emotions or whatever. It's weird when I approach a story, I don't even think about it. It's okay. When I came up with Marvel Season, I thought, all right, I'm going to do this semi-autobiographical story about growing up as a kid. And immediately I drew it that way. I mean, I didn't even plan to draw it that way. It's just how it comes out. And then if I want to draw a horror story, whatever, I'll draw it a certain way, depending on the payoff,
Yeah, I guess, though, that these books, are separate. But, one thing over your career, you've been doing all of these different things at the same time, right?
Yeah. Usually I'm doing 3 books at once.
Yeah,
something like Marvel Season takes top priority. Of course, I did most of my work on that. Used most of my time doing that. But there are a couple of hours or a day that I won't do it. And I'll work on something else that I'm planning on to release in the next couple of years.
Okay, so I want to come back to Huey, the main character here. You mentioned earlier this Captain America play that he puts on, and then he decides that maybe we need to have a movie. And he's really good at getting not only his brothers but his neighbors and his friends sort of, as pawns in his imagination, which is amazing. Did you really have that talent when you were a kid?
Well, I the 2 stories I told were the Captain America play and then my little Trap Behind the Iron Curtain. That's a true story as well. I guess I spoke in a way where people thought, oh, this is going somewhere. But halfway through, they realized, this is bull. I'm going to the park or I want to go play baseball or something.
Yeah, but there's like this sort of like demonic like stage directed, like, no, you will be in my world. You will be in my fantasy. But it also seems, I was thinking back to, like the Crumb family dynamic in that movie. You really had one brother, Charles, who really, kind of forced this regimen of like, we will make comics, we will be drawing comics. And it seems that in your world, we have Huey as the one that, you're getting your little brother excited to hopefully have a future of interested in comics. And the same thing with Venus, we see, with her little sister trying to get her excited about comics. Was there someone in the family, even at this early age when you had comics around, that was like, all right, Hernandez Empire, I see it, it's coming?
Actually, my older brother Mario was like that when we were kids. He felt that, you know, one day, you know, he will publish the world's greatest adventure comic strip magazine. You know, he had these little dreams, you know, he would just talk about it. And, you know, and I was a little kid. I thought, well, he's the older kid, so he knows what he's talking about, you know. So I took it pretty seriously. But the things about that I have with Huey showing his little brother Chavo, like introducing him to the Fantastic Four comic book, that actually happened with my brother Mario showing me. Because this is, okay, bear with me. This was in 1961 when the first issue came out. And Mario just bought it and he was on the couch and I looked at it. And this is really weird for a five-year-old or whatever I was then, four-year-old. I just thought, oh, it's one of those things. You know, whatever comic books were to me then. I don't know. I just remember thinking that one thing. But I remember he was really, you know, enamored with it. Like, oh, man, this is really great. And I looked at it and I still didn't see what was great about it. And then he pointed out things on the cover. You know, he said, okay, this guy's on fire, but, you know, he's going to try to help the girl. And then what really struck me is that the thing, the character that looks like a big green lump, I mean, orange lump, I'm sorry, he's coming toward, you know, he's coming toward the action. He's going to whoop the monster, you know. And he said, this guy here's the good guy, and he's going to save that girl and beat up that monster. And right there, it clicked in my head like, well, there's something. There's something I never thought about. You could have an ugly guy as the good guy, you know. And from then on, that was something that I looked for in other comics and movies and such. And a lot of times I was disappointed. But anyway, that's where that started, just looking at things at a different angle. And so that's, wow. So that's why I put it in the book. But I took credit for it instead of giving it to my brother Mario.
But it is Mario in real life who sort of saw the possibilities of what actually does come to fruition. I mean, the three of you were working together, you know, in those earlier issues. But it's definitely you and Jaime, your brother, who are the career, you know, comics creators. Is with your older brother Mario, did he move on to other things, or was it actually a full time job, sort of stage managing and making this thing come to pass?
That was it in the early days, even since we were kids. He would simply talk about what he wanted to do or what was a good idea, what would be interesting, this and that. And being the little brother and Jaime as well, we just thought, okay, you know, he must know what he's talking about because I sure like, you know, what he's showing us, the comic books and, you know, things like that. But what happened is later, as we Jaime and I started doing our comics for ourselves, Mario started it, but he seemed to have lost interest in it when he was young. So he didn't really pursue it the way me and Jaime did. Jaime and I were just always, you know, making comic books, you know,
machines.
But it was a real passion for us. I mean, you know, they were just little kids scribbles, you know, this and that. But it was something we wanted to do, and we just felt right doing it. And for some reason, Mario kind of lost interest in it. But he always felt like talking about it or thinking about it, but he didn't want to do it. So that's why it was difficult for him to continue doing comics once we started. Jaime and I had already been, you know, practicing since we were five, whereas Mario hadn't really been. So it was difficult for him to do it. And he just was too slow. And he just thought, you know, he'll just do stuff once in a while. And that was it.
Was this difficult? I was in San Francisco a few months ago and I saw that you had the exhibit up at the Cartoon Art Museum. You know, some of the original art going back to some of the early work. And yeah, I was reminded that, you know, it really was the three of you at the beginning. You know, it seemed that, like, he was definitely playing a larger role. Was it an easy transition for just the two of you to move on, or was that difficult?
It was easy in the sense that we could just do those comics. We could fill in the space, you know. Jaime could do so much comics. I could do so much comics. It was a little uncomfortable when Mario, you know, started back off a little bit because we just didn't, I don't know. He just didn't get a lot of support the way Jaime and I did in those early days. And I think he just got, you know, just got tired of it. I don't know. I've never really spoken to him about it too much. And also he had a whole different idea of what kind of comics he wanted to do compared to us. He wanted to do like adventure strips, you know, a little more classic style adventure strips. And we started out doing stuff like that, but got bored of it quickly and started doing the characters. And that's what the book started getting noticed for. And his adventure stuff was pushed back to the point where he just said, ah, forget it. I'll do something else.
Well, in Marvel season, it seems that there's such a strong family bond between the brother, even the one, yeah, it's the way that you deal with the family ties. It seems like it's a very happy, loving family.
No, we fought like crazy. Are you kidding? Well, I don't know how many screen doors we went through in our house because we're always slamming and running in and out, and you know.
All right, so my guest this week on Too Much Information is the cartoonist Gilbert Hernandez, and tomorrow at Housing Works in Soho, he'll be presenting on and showing a slideshow. And I guess I'm going to come introduce you, and we can take some questions from the audience afterwards, and that's tomorrow at Housing Works. But, you know, you're not just a guy with one book out right now. You actually have two. Mm-hmm. That you're on world tour with. Julio's Day is another book that's just came out from a Fantagraphics book. And if I recall this, you know, this one you published serialized in Love and Rockets Volume 2 in the early aughts. And it took quite a long time to finish, if I'm recalling correctly, right?
Yeah, I got sidetracked with other ideas and other stories that I thought took precedent, you know. At first I started out with Julio's Day, but as the comic book, it took a lot longer for it to come out. You know, it was supposed to be like bi-monthly. Then yes. It was supposed to be quarterly, but that never works. But and so I devoted less and less pages to Julio's Day, although I did want to make the 100-page mark because it's about a man's life, 100 years of a man's life. So I wanted to just, you know, for fun, make it 100 pages. And I just kept doing less and less in the book. That's why it took so long to finish. And when I did finish it, I was short. You know, I don't know, 20 pages.
If I recall, it was like a bye, see you later in the comic book, right? It was just like you were just finishing it. So what's different about the version we have, you know, as a complete integral, as they would say in French?
Well, I added some more pages when we switched the formats of Love and Rockets to the one we have now, the book form. Uh-huh. I was able to add a lot of the extra pages I wanted to. That I had just left out because, you know, like I said, I finished the story and I thought, okay, that's enough. And but I still had these other stories ready to do. So I put them in Love and Rockets, the first volume, first issue of volume 3, not really stating that these were Julio's Day stories. You know, they kind of read on their own.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I didn't want to scare anybody away. Like, oh, no, he's still doing this. Yikes. So I just sort of threw the stories in and they kind of sit on their own in that issue. And then when it came to putting out the collection of Julio's Day, I had added 10 pages where I thought felt were much needed to smooth the story out. Yeah. I'm really happy the way it came out. That Julio's Day and Marble Season, I'm really, really happy how both of them came out because, you know, they were hell to do. You know, once you're in the middle of those, you go, what am I doing? This is just, you know, this is not going to work and I'm tired. I'm getting old. But I'm happy with the response so far and I'm really happy how the books look and read.
Yeah.
So, I actually did two books for adults, you know. It's pretty good.
I've always wanted to ask you about the serial nature of comics because it seems like you are someone who's had to have thought about this a lot because you've published in so many different forms, you know, over the past few decades. And it seems that a serial publication offers a creator something really unique, especially when you're dealing with a story like this, Julio's Day, which, as you just said, is the course of one man's life. It's 100 pages, 100 years. It seems that the serial nature of that offers you something. But then again, reading this, you know, start to finish graphic novel also has a sense of completeness to it that the other form doesn't offer at all. And I'm wondering for you, when you think about things like this, what have you sort of sussed out about the serial nature of making works as from a creative sense?
Well, lately I prefer the serial way. The Love and Rockets Volume 2, the comic book version that we did before this new book version, it was funny because Jaime and I each had, 14, 15 pages? And that used to kill us to do, you know, like, oh, we're dying, oh, so many pages. Now we've got 50 pages each. And the idea of doing 14 pages is just amazing to me now. I mean, I could knock that off in a couple of weeks, you know. Yeah. The thing is, I like the serialized version just because you do a chapter, you're done, and you rest or whatever, or get onto a different story, and it comes out a lot more often. Now, you know, the once a year thing makes it weird because everybody's a year older each time they read Love and Rockets, and as we get older, we get older. I mean, you know, every issue I'm, you know, the next issue of Living Rockets, I'll be 56. The next issue after that, I'll be 57. After, you know, and the idea, thinking about that, I think about our older readers, and I'm, boy, they're going to get old really fast.
This story, this guy's going to be 60 when I finish this story.
Oh, yeah, that's why I try not to serialize or anymore or do long stories that are continued anymore, because if I do that, like you said, I'll be 62 when I finish a story. Wow. That's, you know, it's like, yikes, you know, I like to get this stuff out. Yeah. A lot quicker.
There was a comics thing at the University of Chicago last year where I remember Dan Clowes and Charles Burns were both on stage, and they were talking about how at this point they hate the serial nature, like working, like they really like to work on single, you know, start to finish graphic novels. And I think Charles Burns talked about the recent, you know, work he's doing as serialized only because of, you know, publication economic model.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, is there a sense that you've thought about the from an economical sense that the serialization doesn't make sense anymore today, or
well, something those guys must make money because they can do a book every 5 or 10 years. You know, I got to put out, you know, something out almost every month just to make a living. So I like the serialization. I like doing those Dark Horse comics. You know, yeah. That I did recently, like Fatima and. Yeah, and Citizen Rex. I like doing those because I would finish them and then I was on to the next issue and I really liked them. Yeah, it's, and also I have a lot of ideas and my brain is all over the place, so I don't want to do one thing for a year,
yeah.
You know, or 2 years or 5 years like those guys. But they seem to it seems to work for them really well.
Yeah, but it also seems that the nature of comics has always been really tied to the serial nature. I mean, that's for me what makes them so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there seems like something that you definitely lose in the, you know, one book every 5 years sense.
Yeah, and you also are only getting what they worked on for that 5 years. You know, there's no weird stuff like what the old 8-Ball comics were great because he'd have the stories he wanted to tell, but then he'd have like maybe six pages extra, and he would just do anything he felt like.
I know.
You know?
I
and totally that's not agree. Happening anymore with those artists. And I say those artists, I mean the artists I still read and I still love. I always look forward to their books. Well, you know, the next Dan Klaus book comes out, I'll probably be 60. You know, this is what I'm talking about. You know?
Is a lot of that stuff that you just described, like sort of filling in, there's a collection of your work called Fear of Comics. Is that sort of fair to say that, like, that book sort of would highlight maybe perhaps like what you can really get crazy with imagination sometimes?
Oh yeah, I'm really happy with that book. We're going to reprint it with a lot more material because I have a lot more of that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great one.
So it'll have a different title and it'll have that stuff and then more just because I have that stuff. And yeah, I like that book. I like, I was just, it's almost like a comic book you read as a kid that just has so many different stories and different styles.
Yeah.
And usually those old comics were done by different artists. Well, I just put myself in the characters of different artists. And you know.
Well, let's come back to Julio's Day explicitly here. It's in many ways, it's a history where things repeat, but they're also, you know, we end with a very different Julio than the one, you know, where his great uncle that he gets his name from. So whose story is this?
Well, if you'll notice, there's a Julio in every few pages being born. You know, one dies tragically in the mudslide. Another one just sort of he commits murder and he disappears. Another one is happy. The first Julio's his life is conflicted. He's a repressed gay man, and he remains that way for 100 years. Where his great-great-nephew decides to embrace it. He's like the opposite end of it. He just, he wants to live and he wants to be happy. And that's his main concern.
Is it a story you feel that they're both, you know, the Julio in the title? Or is it really, you know, the guy we see die at the end of the book that we've watched get older from childhood?
I personally see it as they're all Julio. Different aspects of his personality. You know, there's a phantom Julio out there that, you know, all these characters, if they all came together, there would be that one. But I separated all the different Julios into different characters, and that's what that was about, using the name over and over.
Yeah. So this book is set in a world that's similar to me, at least in feel and tone, to Palomar, where so many Palomo, where so many of your stories take place. But yet, the politics seem way more in the background here. Was this something intentional? I mean, they happen. I mean, like, the world events, you know, are referenced, but they're definitely, they seem much more in the background.
Yeah, that would, I just wanted to tell the point of view of just, you know, living in a simple life in a small, simple neighborhood where basically all the world events happen off screen. They happen on the news or word of mouth, but they don't really directly touch the characters. And like, except for the one girl, Adeseli, who every time there's a war, she goes, yeah, she goes to help. And then in the end, she dies because she went to help and was poisoned by a diet soda. The point of view of this is the precursor to Marble Season, I guess, where the characters don't really know what's going on, but they hear all this stuff going on and they just kind of try to wrap their head around it as they live their simple lives.
Yeah. And it starts out, you know, very much kind of based in this real world. We have, you know, this character who was poisoned by diet soda, but you also have a character who, you know, these crazy blue worms, worms show up.
Mm-hmm.
That it seems that, you know, again, this magic or these otherworldly forces that show. Was that something you were going to have from the beginning, or just that you just can't help but finding its way into your work?
Yeah, it's the latter. I tried to avoid that sort of thing as much as I could, but when it was coming toward the end, I just thought I just had a hole in the story. I go, something's missing here. Something, I wasn't sure what it was.
That's
so.
In the beginning, though. It's not in the end. I mean, that's, you know, the very early chapter. No.
No, because those stories. The blue worm stuff was toward the end of it originally, and then for the reprint book, I did those stories later. I added the blue worm stuff
on the first walk when the father is walking.
When the father, yeah, that's actually, I told that story. After Julio's Day was the run was finished in Little Rockets, so and I just put it in the front because that's where it belonged. See, I have these plans. You're not supposed to know this.
But that, well, I guess that adventure then, that particular chapter is very important to the story, because on this road where the father gets the worm poisoning, he also meets a very strange young man who are other. Julio runs into later, and mm-hmm. this character has a message for young Julio. He says, "I spent 80 years meeting people, but not having a life of my own. Some life. I don't know what's going on with this guy."
I don't know. I think I just saw the film. I don't even know what it's called. Out in the Wild. No, Out in. I don't know, the one that Sean Penn directed, but the guy who.
Yeah. Yeah. So based society. On the book, yes.
Yeah, I remember seeing that movie and just being furious with this guy, you know. And I just wanted to make that a nicer version of that character, who basically just ignored everybody who, you know, who loved him, and then realized, hey, I'm alone and I'm unloved. You know, some great ending, you know. So it's just sort of a warning.
Yeah, I mean, like, but it's like kind of like going up the mountain, you know. Our this is a cabin in the middle of the nowhere on a mountaintop, and the 80-year-old character recognizes some kind of resemblance from young Julio to the man he met on the road 80 years ago. So it seems like we're getting, like, you know, voice of a wise man on the mountaintop.
Yeah, I mean, and now and again, you see that. I don't know if you see that in real life, but now and again you get that in a book or a film. Or I just thought it fit. I thought it worked for the story, because he's not really, because our Julio, the new Julio, doesn't know who this guy is, never heard of him, but the guy is telling him this thing anyway. Yeah. And anyway, I just kind of put it in there because I thought it fit. You know, I wasn't trying to teach the reader a lesson or anything like that. I just thought that because since of this. Story is about all the different personalities of the Julios. I decided to have a character that, you know, was different from the other characters, you know, a different angle. Say, I like to have different angles of the same question, uh-huh. you know, different answers to the same question. And that was just one of them, different answer to the question of what am I doing with my life type thing, you know?
Uh-huh. So this, you mentioned that Marble Season, the other book, is a much lighter, not a lot of downers in it. And I definitely have to say that there's a lot of tragedy. I mean, Julio's Day seems to be definitely the adult book of the two. There's sex and a lot of sexual abuse early on in the book. And, you know, sexual abuse is something that's, especially with children, that has kind of shown up in your work from, I mean, it's, I guess as far back as I can remember. And I've always wondered, why is this such a theme for you? I mean, for every page you've given us of, like, Venus and Huey and the wonder and magic of childhood, there's also, I can think of countless pages of just savagery and child abuse.
I saw it in my neighborhood. I saw it happen to neighbor kids. I saw, you know, not necessarily the sexual abuse, but just verbal and physical abuse that was pretty much just taken for granted in those days. That you could, it was okay. Like, the only person you can beat up in our society is a kid. You know, oh, you mustn't punch a woman. You never punch a woman. But you can punch a four-year-old kid. What's that about, you know? And even as a little kid, I thought this is the biggest injustice. A kid can't call up the cops and say, my mom just punched me in the face. You know, I've seen kids take punches in the face. So I got a chip on my shoulder about that. So, you know, I just have it in my stories all the time. As a, more or less, just bringing it to light, really, that's still accepted somehow.
You know, I guess that, but it is, you know, again, such a major theme, or at least, you know, shows up so much that when you, it seems that there's a danger, or maybe it's intended by you that this connects then to the way that characters have their sexual identities unfold.
It seems to be that way when you meet a lot of people and you go through a lot of relationships.
Yeah.
You find out the backstory and you go, well, that's why he's nuts or she's nuts, you know. But it's weird how it happens in relationships. They can have perfectly normal lives otherwise. They have a job and friends and, you know, this and that. But when it comes to relationships with people, it goes haywire for some people. And I notice it always connects to a really crappy childhood a lot, oftentimes.
Yeah, so the abuse is mostly coming from things you saw. And did you have, were you conscious when you were a kid how lucky you were in your family that this dynamic wasn't there?
I never really thought about it. It's funny that you bring this up, but I never really thought about it. I mean, I was scolded and got in trouble for, you know.
You weren't punched in the face, though.
I'm sorry?
You weren't punched in the face.
No, luckily. And, but, you know, sometimes I would get a swat here and there, you know. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like, really heavy,
child
really
abuse.
Bad stuff, you know.
Yeah, child abuse.
But like I said, it was just accepted, you know.
Huh. There's also, you know, a lot of gay sex that's shown up in your work. I mean, I think you probably draw on more gay sex than even like a gay cartoonist like Howard Cruz. We may need to check that, but, you know, the actual stats. But it does seem, and there is a lot, and as you are well aware of, there are not a lot of non-gay cartoonists doing this. And mm-hmm. I'm, what is it about, is there something about gay characters that you find really compelling as a storyteller? Or is this just something that has happened naturally?
It's just a natural thing. I'm showing off a lot of the times, you know. Every cartoonist I know, they're afraid to show gay characters in a positive light and even in a sexual light. Well, then I'll do it. You know, two of my, after I read comics in the 60s and that I loved, once I saw underground comics, and in particular Robert Crumb and S. Clay Wilson, I had no fear in what I could put into a comic, you know, if I chose to.
Yeah.
Crumb has gone so much further than I've ever gone and then probably will ever go, yet he's a national treasure, right?
International.
So, yeah, I'm not worried about that then. If this guy can do, you know, express himself the way he has in comics, then what do I have to worry about, you know? And S. Clay Wilson, his stuff is, you know, completely irredeemable, you know, but I love it, you know. He's just really out there just freaking out on his pages and they were published and he's considered a, you know, classic cartoonist now. And I'm like, okay, what do I have to worry about? So I'll put in whatever I want to in a story if I think it fits.
Sure. You know, if I think of like a book that I pulled out the other day that I hadn't looked at in a while, Birdland, you know, the porn comic I don't even want to call it that because again, it features so many of the stories and situations that cross over to some of your, it's definitely a part of the world. But it seems that, you know, when it comes to sexuality and drawing sex, you really went further than you have in say some of your other works. But I guess my question was more specific to just the gay characters. I mean, that who show up, you know, again and again and again. And I just, you know, that as a storyteller, I'm wondering, you know, even in Julio's Day, for example, it seems that like at the end, ending with young Julio, like there's something that just seems to attract you, or that pulls you back to this idea or identity or questioning or figuring out how it all works.
It just seems like to me they're the last group of people in on our planet that people just do not want to have to be considered equals.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. So this book shares, you know, something that all of your work does and the work of your brother, is that you referenced this earlier, is that your characters grow over time. There's not a static nature, you know, in the classic comic sense of where, you know, like the, you know, Charlie Brown never ages, or, mm-hmm. you know, the Fantastic Four still, you know, after crisis, you know, they're still doing the same. They're pretty much in the same point in their lives. Is this always something that you knew would happen from day one with your world?
I wanted to have the characters grow and age, not as fast as they have, or actually they haven't that quickly. It just seems that way. It's been 30 years. But it kind of creeped me out that the Fantastic Four, the little kid, Franklin, is still he's been 5-year-old for what, you know, 40 years? You know? And I just like to move things along. I just like to see characters age and, you know, that was it, my model was the old comic strip, Gasoline Alley,
yeah,
which actually the characters aged over time. And I just liked that. I just thought that gave it some resonance that no other comic strip had.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, kept that in the back of my head when I started doing Palomar. I just felt that's what I was going to do with it.
Yeah. I love that these books are both out at the same time, too, because they really showcase the variety of your universe. And they show that, you know, your world kind of transcends genres. Your stories, you know, can transcend continents, time, formats. I mean, I could probably throw in any word I want. I mean, I could definitely go on. But I'm curious if there's something that you feel like ties everything together. Or is it just your imagination being so big, you need all these different genres and worlds?
Yeah, it is that. It's just my personality is on the page, you know, even the darker stuff, you know. It's I'm simply seeing myself as an artist that is able to express, you know, my thoughts and feelings on the page. And even if, you know, a lot of times I do crime stories or horror comics, I obviously don't want these bad things to happen to people. But once it's on the page, I mean, a comic book can't hurt you. It's a story. You know, I know we're dealing with drawings, and I know that's a different thing from reading a novel because it's all in your head. But I just do it because that's just me. I have overactive imagination. I'm very self-conscious. I'm like Huey, excuse me, where he just, you know, he's just buzzing all the time. You know, he just can't relax. He, you know, that's how I am.
Huh. And, you know, you talked about like Crumb's influence and the Underground's influence and sort of, you know, making it possible to do new things. But it seems, you know, today that I would say you and your brother were very influential in sort of showing that all of these different genres could be mixed and done sort of at the same time. And did you have a role model or someone that sort of showed that to you back then? And, you know, when you were getting started, that you mentioned, like, I don't want to do adventure comics. I kind of feel that what you did, there wasn't really a model for.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have that sense?
Yeah. I guess the two artists I can think of at the top of my head that did do that, was Crumb and Jack Kirby. Hmm. Jack Kirby did every kind of comic book you could do in mainstream comics. You know, and Crumb did every kind of story he felt like doing in his own world. You know, different styles, different attitudes, different angles of things. He just did it because he was his own comic shop. And that's what I always thought of Love and Rockets, as Love and Rockets is a comic shop. That's why you have superhero stories and, you know, sometimes a horror story and sometimes just a kid story or whatever, because that's how we read comics. You know, the only comics we didn't read were, as kids, were romance comics, but that's only because, you know, it was all boys. You know, there's no romance comics coming into the house.
I love that you call it a comic shop. I mean, a lot of times over the years, a friend will come over and they'll see, you know, the shelf of, you know, Love and Rockets comics on my shelf, and be like, wow, I've always wanted to read this. Which one should I start with? And you know, I would make the worst comic store employee ever. I don't know. what is officially for you? Like, what do you feel a way for someone who wants to check your world out and sees that, man, there are a lot of options?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. This is why I'm so happy about these new books coming out. I would start them out with either Julio's Day or Marble Season.
Or both.
Because you could show Marble Season, you go, this is for all ages. You can read this to a kid if you want to. And if you want to read something for adults, for them, you know, for real adults, I don't mean just because they're grown up, you know, and but they're still playing video games. Julio's Day, you know. I've never really had books I could show, just hand to people, go, okay, this is what, this is for adults, you can read this. This is for kids or all ages, and you can read this. So I'm happy with both these books coming out now.
Yeah, I would have to say, though, that both, you need both, because, I mean, again, one of the things that has always amazed me about your talent and genius as an artist is that you have the versatility to do it all at once. So that would be my recommendation. I want to thank you so much for joining me for the show today.
It's been my pleasure to talk about myself.
My name is Benjamin Walker. Our guest today has been Gilbert Hernandez, and you can check him out tomorrow at Housing Works when he'll be in town to sign copies of Marble Season. And I believe you're going to have a slideshow.
Yeah, it's not going to be as long as so. Don't worry. Don't get scared, anybody. It's going to be pretty short. It's just using examples of comics that were pivotal in inspiring me to do what I do.
So when you have two projects like this that, you know, again, are decades of work that you've been doing, do you feel like a sense of relief that, you know, you have some time to figure out what you're going to do next? Or are you always and already working on what's next?
That's it. I'm working on the I've already handed in my artwork for The Next Love and Rockets, which should be coming out in September, hopefully. And I'm finishing up a major graphic novel for the end of the year. Based loosely on the Palomar series. It's called Maria M, but it's completely different from Julio's Day and Marble Season in that it's really heavy on the violence and sexual graphics.
More face punching.
probably quite a bit.
So thanks again to Gilbert Hernandez for chatting with me the other day. We did that via Skype. And so he'll be in town on his world tour tomorrow. If you check the Accu playlist page, I'll post a link to that. So my name's Benjamin Walker. This is Too Much Information. See, that's what we're trying to do now with the show. Hour-long conversations. And next week, we're going to have Richard Hell on, which is going to be kind of awesome. Really looking forward to recording with him. And all that information is at WFMU.org. So stay tuned. Nerd War is up next.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show.
Cleo.
Yeah, yeah. We got something in there. Come
And you're listening to WFMU. And it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. You just heard right there, EU, with the EU Freeze, the great go-go sound from Washington, D.C. A go-go sound that is really admired by Pharrell Williams, producer Pharrell Williams from NERD and the Neptunes. And today on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with Pharrell Williams from 2008 and a brand new interview with Pharrell Williams from 2013. Pharrell Williams, today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. To kick it off, here's another one of Pharrell Williams' favorite sounds, the sounds of Rex and Effects with Rex and Effects on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU.
Yeah, boy, Rex and Effect, we can do this, huh? Like this. KC is in effect, yeah. I'm dedicated to microphone rocking. When I'm on the mic, I don't think about stopping it. Another MC rapper try to steal the show. Ruin his career when I go for what it knows.